So in the years that I've been working in this community, I've noticed kind of an attitude a little bit of like how it should be. And people,
this community, do you mean Fort Collins?
Yes, or? Fort Collins, yeah. Like people should educate themselves, people should speak up, people should come to meetings. And from a grassroots community organizing perspective, if people aren't doing those things, that's because folks who have the resources, the knowledge, access to the meetings, like, are not doing good organizing. Right? So this approach is about the responsibility of people who are already involved and like how we see ourselves and how we work. And so the attitude of this kind of approach is like everybody who could get here is an organizer already. Everybody who already knows something about the issues that we're fighting or where the resources are, like the info shop or what is Uproot or what is CJPE, is in the position of being an organizer. Over the years, I've had a lot of conversations with people in which people seem to have really bad associations with the word organizing. And most of what folks said about organizing didn't really match up with how I was trained to organize, but I kind of was silenced by these really negative attitudes, which is why I never really explicitly shared any of my training about that stuff. Because every time I would bring up the word organizing or bring up the idea of organizer training, people were like, were so negative about it that I didn't go forward. But I've kind of changed how I feel about that a little bit this summer, because within a few weeks of my arriving here, several people who are friends of mine came, like I was hanging out with them privately, and they had pretty serious complaints about like how they'd been treated at meetings or like how they found it difficult to get involved in the community. And that made me start thinking about like why I hadn't shared this information before. So my training in community organizing is the method used by Mel King. And so I feel like I kind of carry that. I've been carrying it, but I haven't been sharing it. And I want to tell you a little bit about him. He's been a neighborhood organizer in the South End of Boston for probably now nearly 50 years, because he's like in his 70s, and he's been working there since he was a pretty young man. Just started out as like an outreach worker working with youth, and he's worked with a lot of different social service agencies. And then eventually he was elected to be state rep from his district, and he did a lot of very, probably the most radical work that you can do that's legislative in terms of really delivering resources to the communities. And he believes that communities should control their own resources, so he was always fighting for the resources that got delivered to be completely controlled by the community. And he's also done a lot of organizer training over the years. In 1979, he ran to be the mayor of Boston. And he would have, if he was elected, and he ran again in 1981. And if he had been elected, he would have been the first black mayor of Boston, which, if you're not don't know about Boston, is like an amazingly racist town that's controlled by ethnic, some parts of it are controlled by ethnic Irish people who are pretty publicly racist, and some parts of it are controlled by ethnic Italian people who are similarly racist, although they control different stuff. So, and he almost was elected in that town. And a lot of why he was elected has to do with his organizing strategy. He believed in community self-determination, which some of us might call anarchism. So I had some of that framework for a really long time, and then like learned the word anarchism a lot later. But he believed that communities had the capacity to control and manage their own stuff, and they didn't need outside experts and bureaucrats and the state to tell them how to manage their stuff. And he was always fighting for communities to get to be in control of their own, like schools, police, any kind of like public buildings should be open to the community and available for use. People should control their own housing. Like he, that was his approach, which comes out of the tradition of Black Power. It's one of the more radical articulations of what Black Power would look like. And so when he ran for mayor, he organized each, he believed each neighborhood should be organized and powerful. And so he was working with the Black and Latino neighborhoods a lot, but he was encouraging the same policies for all of the neighborhoods. So he was like promoting the idea of being this rainbow coalition, because Boston's very segregated. So the idea of his rainbow coalition was like each community was actually pretty ethnically coherent, and they each community should maintain their culture. In order to maintain your culture, you control your own institutions, and then you're in alliance, in a rainbow alliance with the other communities. That was the second, his was the second vision of a rainbow coalition in the US. The first vision was articulated by Fred Hampton, who was a Black Panther, in 1968. And then Mel King expanded on that idea, made it really concrete in this vision of neighborhood governance in Boston in the late 70s, early 80s. And then when he decided to stop running for mayor, I don't know what point or why he did this, but he called up Jesse Jackson and said that he thought Jesse Jackson should use the idea of a rainbow coalition for a national presidential campaign, which Jesse did. But Jesse's rainbow coalition had a lot of elements that seemed similar to Mel's, but it's not clear that he was as committed to community self-determination as Mel was. So that's a little bit about him. And he's the kind of person who goes to a meeting and he doesn't leave the room until people have committed to organizing to solve the problem. People have articulated a problem, he's like, what are you gonna do? How are you gonna, you know? And it's like, he just gets people to take the responsibility of organizing. He's a really powerful organizer. So I'm gonna be going over a bunch of his ideas. This style of organizing also comes, he's not like the only person to ever say it, he's just the person who trained me. Some other places where it gets, this style is pursued are the Highlander Center, which is in Tennessee, Newmarket, Tennessee. And it's been a training center for organizers since like way back before the Civil Rights Movement. And actually the Highlander Center was one of the first schools of any kind in the South that broke the laws about having people of different races sleeping in the same dormitories. And they've always been at the forefront of civil rights, well, not civil rights, racial justice work. And their strategy, what they've been doing for many decades and what they still do, and their vision is that they have this room that's a circle of rocking chairs. And they invite organizers and like activists in their communities to come and sit in the rocking chairs and share strategies. What works. So they are very, have like a really anti-hierarchical approach to education and knowledge. And this approach is also really influenced by the work of Paulo Freire, who's a really radical Brazilian revolutionary Marxist educator, who also believes in like self-education. And the premise there is that all people who are living in the world know about their problems. And they know what they've tried to do to solve them, and they know the little pieces that have worked. So if people, if you can create environments that empower people to talk about what's up, then people will solve their own problems. So there's some minimal role for facilitators, for creating space, for getting people together. But the basic idea is like people are plenty smart enough just to do what they need to do. And it's kind of, I think, empowering to realize, like for anarchist folks to realize that like there are all these other traditions that have been working on the same conceptions and goals that we might be working on. And that maybe, like, when we get stuck, we could look at the Black traditions, we could look at the civil rights traditions, we could look at all kinds of other traditions that don't call themselves anarchists but have the same beliefs about people's capacities to self-govern and the capacities of communities to solve their own problems. So community organizing is about power. It's about building power, for which the biggest resource, and this is empirically, historically documented, if we want social change, the biggest resource is people. We need all the people. And that's why it frightened me or concerned me when people came to me, even just three people coming to me saying, I went to a meeting, I had a terrible experience, and I never went back. You know, like, we can't really afford to lose people. And if we're alienating the people who did get their butt in the door, imagine what we're doing to people who haven't got their butts in the door yet, right? So that made me feel like we really need, this community has so much awesome stuff going on, and we really need to learn some more about how to be organizers. So I decided, instead of going to Boston for the DNC, I would bring what I learned in Boston many years ago here. That's part of why I decided to stay home, is to envision this project as what I did instead of that.
Oh.
It's getting calls on Cheryl's phone already.
What up, G? We're having a meeting. You want to come by? Yep. You can come by whenever. Sooner the better. Do you know where to go? Yeah, it's at the Common House. So it's down at the end. Cool deal. Thanks.
So I'm going to just go through, like, are we making another phone call?
I was going to call you.
Okay.
I have a question while
he's
on the phone. So if Mel King's sort of take is that he doesn't let anybody leave a meeting without something to do, how does he get them there in the first place? Because it's harder to get somebody to a meeting when they
don't. Usually people are already organized,
yeah.
At least that there's a problem, and they invite him to come.
Okay. So they're expecting that.
Yeah. But his thing is, like, to move people from the, like, we have a problem phase, where people usually already know they have a problem.
Nice.
And his, like, work is to move people to the willingness to, like, take action. And there's a lot of different barriers to taking action. Like, people are scared. People don't feel like they have time. People don't feel powerful. There's all sorts of stuff. So he helps people, like, develop a vision that they are going to be able to take action. Which is a really nice thing to do, you know?
Are we doing, when you're talking and stuff, or are you just going to kind of lay it out? Are we going to talk about some of these things? Or?
I think, like, that was the introduction, and that now I think we should just, as discussion, come as each of the ideas. I just have, like, a long list of sort of ideas and principles that I learned that seem useful. And I think we could, like, discuss those as we go along, you know, whenever something comes up for people. But did you have something about the first part or a question?
Well, just about, like, the alienation and stuff. We're going to talk about that.
Why we think it's happening.
Should we go through our
problems?
Well, actually, that might be good for sort of, like, trying to put some of these ideas into practice, like, later, like, a little bit of brainstorming about if any of these are relevant to what's happening here.
All right, cool.
You know, and, like, maybe how we could see some of that stuff differently.
It's easy for us to, like, dissect our community, but there's nothing really to base upon, you know, like, there's no other way to judge it, you know, like, because we've never been a part of any other, I've never been part of any organizing, other organizing communities, so I don't know how to, like, judge our community?
Well, the basis on which I'm judging it to the extent that I am is that we're alienating people in this community.
Right.
And well, my framework says that's a problem.
But I'm saying, is this a specific problem? Is it like specific to Fort Collins, or is this a general thing that like all communities are falling into to a degree?
I don't think that. I mean, that doesn't. I'm sure some of these problems are shared.
Right.
But that probably everybody needs to work on this stuff to different.
Right. I'm just thinking as a general level, as far as kind of not maybe specific things with.
Maybe some of the stuff that Amory is going to talk about.
Right.
Now,
right.
Explore.
I was just trying to.
Okay. All right.
To be clear.
Yeah, I have a question also. So we're going to talk about ways that other people address problems in organizations. And then could we talk about problems in Fort Collins,
sure.
And then adopt
yeah.
those solutions?
That
to
would
what
be great.
Here,
I think that would be great. If I can go over the principles and we have questions about the principles, maybe a little discussion as we go through, and then I'll stop. And we could collectively think about which of these things really apply or are new ideas for this community and stuff. And oh, wow, well, maybe, that might be a problem or that might work or maybe we should try this or whatever. Okay, so this is really just a long list of principles. one is to pay attention to the people who are in the room. So at a session like this, it would be really easy to be where's so-and-so and why aren't more people here? And to kind of be a little obsessed with that. And the idea is the people in the room are the folks to pay attention to at that point, right? At another point, we might want to analyze why is turnout low. But once we're here, every person who's here, this is amazing, this is valuable. We're going to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 more people in this community who know this stuff. That's huge. And those are the people to be worried about, not the people who, why they didn't get here. So that's one principle. And that is important, if you're the one speaking or organizer introducing, in terms of how you treat people. I'm sure we've all been to events where the organizers were pissed off about turnout, and they were not excited and welcoming to the people who did get there. So that's just one small principle. Another principle, work with the people who are ready to move. And that, you can implement that idea at a lot of different levels. If you're doing campaign planning, do you want to go after the people that you think are most against you and try to change their mind? Or do you want to try to work with the people who are already close to where you're at and figure out how to get them to kick it up to the next level? Right? If you're wanting to do a project, there's some people that are hanging around all the time, quietly seeming interested. Those people are ready to move. Those people are good folks to be working with. And so it's a little bit of a shift in consciousness sometimes about how we think all those people out there that we have to go organize. And to actually think about who's showing a readiness to move, and let's focus on working with those people. And not worry about the people who are really far away from us, conceptually, or who can't ever get to the meeting or whatever. Right. The third, or these aren't really numbered, so I want to talk a little bit about Mel's notion of the importance of community. This is from his book, Chain of Change, which is a history of Black power movements and similar movements in Boston and how they dealt with a whole series of things and how over time, exactly how the neighborhoods, the communities, the organizations got radicalized and got more more into self-determination. What was the process that moved people from asking for services from the state to actually being self-determining? It's a history of that. So kind of want to talk a little bit about community. Um, why is community, and this is like, you know, anarchism without the word, right? Why is community so important? It's a matter of humanity. Creating and maintaining community is the best way to meet people's needs. People relate better, more completely in a community. Working with their neighbors, people can accomplish an amazing amount of good, which will not happen under an impersonal government program. We need to make use of the person next door and not depend on people outside the community to solve our problems and satisfy our needs. People also flourish in a more personal environment. Their strengths can be cultivated, their weaknesses improved upon with the support of neighbors who possess complementary skills and strengths. Community counteracts the frustration, depersonalization, and fragmentation which our current society forces on people. If it is these aspects of community which are most crucial, the definition of community development leans heavily on human development. The most natural ingredient for developing the best possible resources in a community are the people themselves. It's not the physical structures or the dollar signs that count in the end, but the way people feel about themselves, each other, and the place that they live. So he, like, it's just like laying out, like, you know, what community is and why this is important. And why we want to, like, go to our neighbors and do think, you know, what the connection is between community and power, developing community. So if we think, like, I've really got the info shop on my mind these days. We think about the info shop, we have this structure. It's a great structure, it's a great space, it's a great thing. Right, but really what the info shop is about is whether people use it, whether people care for it, whether people find it to be valuable, whether people feel responsible for it, right? It's the people that make the info shop really something that works. Books in a room don't do it. So he's saying, what's the issue with the human development there? So we might analyze that a little bit, like what's going on with the community around there, what's going on with how people feel about it, and themselves and their relationship to it. Then the next important principle is the idea of process versus product, which is a really important and widespread issue in community organizing. And it's a really hard issue, which is like, we have goals we're going to be talking about later about when we do action planning. We want to get things done, right? We want to shut down the World Bank. We want to build the info shop. We want to stop the war. We want to deal with police issues that are happening immediately. And those are really urgent things. And so there's always a tendency to try to do those things as efficiently as possible, right? We want to stop the war, and what we've decided to do about that is like have a really big educational rally, and we should have our very best speakers speak, because that's the best way to convince people that the war is wrong. Let's have our best speakers speak, because that's going to be the fastest, easiest, quickest way to get the thing done. And from a like radical grassroots community organizing perspective, you never choose the easiest way. Not because it's easy, but because that's a product orientation, getting it done. And what we really need to have as our top priority always is the process. And by process, we don't mean have a therapy group and talk about your feelings. By process, we mean maximize human development, maximize skills development along the way. So in every project, if it's gonna, like the most, whatever, revolutionary way to do your project is the way that's gonna leave the most skills with the most number of people at the end of the project. And ultimately, that's more important than winning the thing at hand, which is like really hard to accept. You want to talk about that?
I just think this kind of ties into the whole racism thing, because it's really easy to have the rich white guy do all this stuff and do all the leading because he's got the time. But you know, I think it just sort of all ties together because you're not using community resources, people resources, and it's sort of a bad habit to fall into.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the anti-work I've done with other groups, the number one, like, excuse that's brought forth with, like anti-racist or anti-sexist critiques is it, well, we're working on the war right now. We don't have time for that. We need to stop the war. And it's true with anything. We need to stop this. We'll talk about sexism and racism later.
And often, just on a task level, there's like somebody around who can do the thing easily. And it takes more work and more time to get somebody else involved with that task. But if the person who already knows how to do it does it again, they're not, and then what if that person leaves the community? Or what if that person has a health crisis and can't be as involved, right? And are other people then feeling the same kind of empowerment and like efficacy that that person felt? So that leads into this one of Mel's favorite stories that he told me so many times, and it's a great story. When he was elected state representative, he, you know, he was seen as this like powerful person in the community who could get shit done, you know. So one of his constituents, who's a woman, called one day, and she was having like a problem with something to do with her, she was in public housing, something to do with her housing, or something with, that she needed the state to fix the thing. And she called him up and she said, "They've screwed me, I need you to fix it. You're my representative." And he gave her the phone number of the person that she needed to call and what she needed to say, and like told her what her rights were in the situation and like how she could get it solved. And she got really angry at him, and she was like, "You're my representative, I want you to do it for me." And he said, "But if I do it for you, then I still have the power. If you do it, then you have the power." And she was still angry, but he was really strict about that with people, right? That the people who already know how to do the stuff need to pass the skills and then kind of make a boundary about like, "I'm not gonna keep doing this because that leaves me with all the power." This is really, it was an interesting.
It's really hard to do that sometimes though, if you have like a project and you feel like if you don't do it, then it's just not gonna happen at all, you know? Like when we tried to do a Food Not Violence chapter down in Durango, like it was just a couple of us. And it was like, if I didn't go out and do the pickups, like I didn't feel like anyone else was going to. And I, you know, you'd like try and encourage people, and if they didn't, then you just do it anyway. And it's like, and I didn't draw that boundary, and it's just like same core of people doing it over and over again. It's like, I mean, what do you do in situations like that where you don't have those people, like they don't commit or like follow through with that, what they say they'll do? You know, do you just let it go and like let the project dissolve and stick to that process? I mean, I don't know. It's hard.
Yeah, it is a hard issue, and I think there's more coming about that, too. But this particular story, I mean, again, keep in mind the issue of, like, that he had the power to fix this thing for another person. And that's when he made kind of a strict boundary, which is a little bit of a different situation than, like, we're an organization, are we going to get the food served or not? You know, it's a slightly different situation where, like, like, if somebody comes to you and you know how to fix the thing for them, and it's like there's a big psychic payoff to fixing the thing for them, right? Because then you get to feel powerful. You get to feel like, I took care of him, you know? Like, it's, there's a payoff for the person with the power. And it's actually, in the, some of these situations, it's like a little bit of like you're losing something to say, "Hey, why don't, you know, I teach you how to do it?" Because then, I think sometimes, particularly activists, don't take responsibility for how we do get some psychic payoff from controlling the knowledge, right? So I think it's a little different, but the stuff you're raising, I think there's some ideas that are coming up. But it's also the issue of, like, in that same, going back to that same situation, it's also an issue of, like, taking the time You know, if you have the power and you know how to do the thing, it's so damn easy to just do it, right? And the process of teaching someone else how to do it for themselves is like kind of more of a commitment in a way.
But I think you should feel like somewhat obligated to teach somebody new skills if you can, to an extent.
That's,
you
know? Yeah. I think that's part of the theme is like, when I said that everybody here is already organizers, if we're here, I think the theme is kind of like taking responsibility that we do know stuff when you do have skills, and so there's a responsibility there already. Okay, so then another important idea is that, and this is another quote from the same book, a community approach to problem solving involves the greatest number of people possible. This increases the amount of creativity, and it increases what's called ownership, which I'll define in a second. It also, the idea is like the more diversity in the room, the better the ideas. And Mel's always saying, everybody's a genius. So like the more of these geniuses who, and we are really geniuses about our own experience. You know, like nobody can tell you about your life like you, right? Like we know what's screwed up and what doesn't work. I mean, like talk to CSU students about like the core curriculum at CSU. They are experts on every single thing that is wrong with that damn curriculum and how it's unfair and how it doesn't actually accomplish any of its own goals and how it has nothing to do with education. They're experts about that. So if you got like 10 CSU students together, they could rewrite that curriculum, do a really good job, right? So like bringing people together, like some other approaches that are not grassroots community organizing, like worry, like if you have too many people, oh my God, it's gonna be, we're gonna fight, or you can't take care of everyone's voices, or like you just wanna keep things small. And this approach is you always fling the doors open, always. When there's a community issue or a community problem, you always invite. And I think that is actually something that we generally do in this community. But you will definitely notice in other communities or other spaces that there's sometimes this thing of like, oh no, let's just get together the people who we think know about it and solve the problem. So that's just wanted to kind of include that, even though I think it's something that we're better at here. The issue of ownership though, which I said I'd define, like when people are involved in helping to make the decision about the plan or to be part of the process at any point, they then feel on a psychological level a little bit of ownership, like, oh yeah, well I knew about that, or like yeah, I was at that meeting, even if they didn't speak. So including people in the process increases folks feeling that this is their project. They can be proud of it. And that's something that draws folks in. This is another issue that I don't think has come up that much in this community, but I want to make sure to include it, which is the idea of working with existing organizations and infrastructure. Standard community organizing practice is you got a new project you want to work on, you don't do anything about it until you find out who's already been working on it. And go like talk to them in a very humble way. You don't go talk to them about like, I have this great idea. You talk to them about like, so I hear you've been working on police accountability issues for like a really long time in this community. Like, what's up with that? You know, like what's going on? What's the history? I wanna learn. You know, where are you at with that? Do you need help? What are the other areas that you'd wanna take it, directions you'd wanna take it? And talking to all the people. And since I've been here, I don't think I've seen this happen in this community, but I've had some other experiences in other places where like folks came in and wanted to do a new project and almost immediately had a whole bunch of really useful folks with experience pissed off at them because they didn't respect that those people had already been working on it. And it's just a it's a straightforward respect thing. Like, you've been struggling with something for a long time, and some young folks come in who are kind of green, and they start making a big show or throwing money at the thing, and you're like, yo, I've been working on this for a long time. Like, why is our group not included? Or, you know, so do, before you start new projects, like, do your research on who else has been working on it and go have respectful conversations with them about it. And ideally, get them involved. Like, they're the elders on the issue. They may not be much older than you, but they might have more experience with that issue in that place, and therefore they're kind of elders. And,
what if, I mean, a lot of people work on different projects in this community and stuff. There's not a lot of access to knowledge that other people are working on that and stuff. I agree with that point and stuff, but also, I mean, I think it's kind of a little condescending to be like, oh, there's the elders and they know what's going on. And if you have a lot of energy for some project, you have to, like, go seek out, like, the knowledge and stuff, and you can't just spawn something on your own. I don't know, like, especially if the information is out there, like, if someone's coming in and is excited about a project, they don't already know the existing structure, how is it their responsibility if they're not getting that information to begin with? And, like, if people are getting angry,
again, it's not saying people can't do it or that it's their responsibility. This is about effective community organizing that will build power in the long term. So it's not like a judgment or condemnation of people who do it differently. It's just a matter of, like, well, if all that you've just pissed off all the people who have experience with your issue in your community, that's not the best start.
That's complete interpretation, though. If they're getting angry,
well,
they're pissed
off. It's an empirical thing that folks have observed many times. Mm-hmm. Like, just imagine if the, like, human rights office, whatever, in Fort Collins somehow got a big grant for $200,000 to do immigrant rights workshops. Mm-hmm. And they started, like, doing all this stuff, you know? And they didn't work through Fuerza Latina? First of all, they're going to alienate the members of Fuerza Latina, right? Who are going to be like, we trust this organization, we've been working with them, like, who are you, right? Second, if they then want to go to, Kim Salinas? If they go to Kim Salinas and we're like, oh yeah, we want you to come speak at our thing, she's going to be like, She's the person in the community who probably has the most knowledge about, like, what's up and what needs to happen next, and she's going to be like, you just got the $200,000. You didn't even talk to me about it. You didn't include me in your plan. So it's pragmatic. It's not like you're evil if you don't do it this way. It's just a pragmatic issue of how to be most effective in building power, which is that before you start something, you do research. You wander around town. And there was actually a woman who moved to town. Her name was Carrie. And I could tell, you remember Carrie?
Mm-hmm.
I could tell immediately that she'd been trained. She was very quiet. She found us, found Uproot through, I don't know, the co-op or something. You go to somewhere, you find a place where you think you can, you start asking questions. Hey, who works on IMF World Bank issues in town? And then she was like, so what have you guys been doing? So do you need help? You know, like, she started out really humble. She turned out to probably be one of the most skilled organizers that's ever been in this town. But she came in, and I saw it right away what she was doing. She came in, like, totally humble. She didn't alienate anyone or, like, you know, piss people off in that process. She was totally, you know, just what I mean? Like, it's just a matter of, like, how to be effective. It's not a judgment. Yeah, go ahead.
So what I'm saying is you've got two ends. You've got someone who's coming into the town that's new. You've got the town who's been working on all kinds of issues. What would be great for us and for the city of Fort Collins to create as a resource where someone could just access it, and it'd be great on the Center for Justice, Peace, and Environment website, and just have all of the contact information and what the history is with each issue, so you could just access this, find out everything at once, who to contact, and then what to do about it. So. And you could do that the first day you get into Fort Collins and not have to spend a year kind of searching around, looking for people and issues and what's happening. So I think it'd be great to get together and just kind of create this resource, and I've been thinking about that for a little while. So.
Yeah. This thing also would apply, though, to people who've been here for a while who might be starting a new project, you know, to think about, like, wait, well, who's worked on it already, you know? So it applies to new people, for sure, but also to folks who just are starting something new.
And for people that don't realize that anything's happening.
Right.
I mean, it's a great way for people that have been here the whole time and just realize, oh, I could actually do something in Fort Collins, have some kind of a resource for them to access, and then make it much, much easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the next principle, and again, I'm sorry these aren't like more flowing from one to the next, but I tried to organize them. Then it's in terms of like how to build solidarity with other people or other groups, like, showing up for people's stuff, whether you're interested in it or not, is a basic principle. So, like, and I think, again, this is something actually that is done pretty well in this community. Like, if you want a group to come to participate in your action, the best way to get that to happen is go participate in their action or first. Or ask them how you can be supportive, right? Rather than going and talking to a group about why your cause is so fabulous and they should definitely care about it, the best way to get that relationship built is to just like show up at their stuff quietly. Like, be there. They do a call to action. And maybe you don't think their action is really well designed, or you don't think their action is radical enough, or you don't think their action is interesting. It's still how you build solidarity. You just show the fuck up. That's kind of like a standard method. And the same thing with people, you know, like, if you're trying to build a relationship with a person and they, you know, are in a band, and you're hoping that this person maybe could, like, they kind of seem interested in your organization, but they kind of seem shy, and you're kind of like wanting to encourage them maybe to be more involved. Like, if you show up at, like, their band has a little show, then they're seeing, like, oh, wow, this is a relationship, this is developing, these people see me, they're treating me like a person, they're interested in me. That can also help build the relationship between that person and the organization. One of the things that I think that there's a lot of, when I talked in the introduction, when I talked about, like, the shoulds, like, people should show up, people should be committed. One of the things that I feel like is hard for me to face, and I think hard for other folks to face, is that really how this stuff works is personal relationships. And we would like to think that people stumble across a website that says what's wrong with the World Bank, and they then become a diehard activist. And it's true that that does happen for some people. But mostly what happens is people develop a personal relationship with someone who cares about that thing, and then feels like, oh, well, yeah, okay, I'll come to your teach-in. Like, that sounds really cool, like, because I like this person who I met, and they seem really smart, and it seems like an interesting issue, and I think I'll go learn more. Like, in terms of mobilizing people, it's almost all personal relationships, unfortunately. Like, I don't like to face that. I would like it to all be much more objective. So, building community, organizing is really about developing personal relationships, which is something that we're all capable of doing, whether we feel like we could stand up and give a speech about what's wrong with the World Bank or not. We all are capable of building personal relationships, which means that we're all perfectly capable of being organizers, right? How do you build a personal relationship? You ask the person questions. It's really easy. Hey, what's up with you? You know, what are you interested in? Why'd you come to this thing? How'd you hear about it? So when we see new people at our events, if we want them to come back, We need to build relationships with them.
Seems like it could be a fragile way of having a community together at all, though, because once that personal relationship has any kind of schism of any sort, like, then the other person might not care about the issues anymore because it was all through the mm-hmm. person to begin with.
I don't think we have any control over that, though.
Yeah.
Because that's really what...
Hopefully, in the course of their relationship, they've built commitment to the cause and will stay in
right.
it, even if it's
uncomfortable. Or they've built multiple personal relationships, right? So, like, you're at the teach-in, and some guy you've never seen before comes in and stands at the back, and, like, you're not really sure if he's going to stay. We want him to become an activist, right? Somebody can appoint themselves to cruise over and be like, hey, did you get the program? You know what we're doing here today? Can I answer any questions? So right away, here's a friendly person, and they have a little relationship. This person, say that this guy comes to a meeting, he comes back. Fabulous. Introduce him to more people. You know, like, ask questions. Like, do the work of building the links. Community is about the links, the actual relationships, and that's what makes folks... Not every single person, but most people need that, unfortunately. And it's also like it's human behavior, you know, like what are people into? Oh, that's interesting. Maybe you'll gain something from that experience of getting to know them. And what this also means, what goes along with this, is that personal contacts and reminders are essential. It would be really nice if email worked. It would be really easy. But actually, often what works, and it's fascinating to me, like, because I've been doing a lot of, like, showing this film around the state recently, and for me to, like, look at who shows up and how many of those people I did a personal contact with, like, it'll be, like, compared to the, like, I know that, like, the invitation to the film screening has gone out to, like, 1,200 people. 20 people show up, 4 of them are people I had personal contacts with. And I did personal contact with 20 people or 30 people, right? So the ratio of, like, getting people there through the personal contact is, like, incredibly more effective than sending out the emails. And reminders. And that's part of why, like, for years I've been saying, you know, we really need to work with these handbill-sized stuff. And when there's a community event, everybody who's an organizer, which I think is everybody, has those in their pocket for the weeks or however long we have coming up to it, because then you can make contact with people and give them the reminder. Like, that kind of work, it's really easy, and we all could be doing a better job of it. So, but it takes, like, we need to get the flyers made and get them distributed and kind of create a culture of doing that sort of work. Another piece that kind of goes with this business of, like, building relationships is that parties don't do it. Parties are a manifestation of already having community.
Of already what?
Having community. Like, when you've already done the work of building relationships, and then you throw a party, you will know you've done a good job of building relationships because a lot of people will come to the party. But the party doesn't do the work. And that's something that's really mistaken. I've heard over the years so many times, like, people complaining about, like, not enough connection, or people not knowing each other, or people not feeling comfortable, or not enough something in the community. And the answer is always potluck, to which the same 5 people go, maybe, or 10. And none of those problems ever get solved at the potluck, because the people who have the problem didn't go. And the people who do go, like, hang out and have a good time. But it never solves the, like, we don't know each other well enough. You know, people aren't getting to know each other, or people aren't comfortable, or people don't feel safe, or people don't think our meetings are fun, or so the solution is potluck.
Isn't this a potluck?
This is not a party.
I mean, it's not food, but we're having, I mean, like, in that same kind of sense, though, like, we're talking about our problems as a community together.
Yeah.
We're not eating food and stuff, but we are, like, organizing in a potluck kind of way.
Structure. You know,
like, in that structure. That same kind of analogy can be used for what we're doing.
Well, in the sense of the work needed, personal relationships work needed to be done to get folks here, The point is just that people often see having a party as a solution to problems, but throwing a party doesn't do the work of building relationships, of like, hi, I haven't met you before. You know, like, are you interested in these issues? Like, what's up? How'd you find out about this? Like, it doesn't do that work of like, oh my God, now there's a friendly face, right? When there's no friendly face, you don't go to the party. Or very few people
so
do.
So you're saying, like, do that work outside of the community
yes.
before you have it.
And, well, or see that as, like, the solution. Like, I'm just saying, like, parties are fine. Parties are great. Have as many parties as you want. But don't see parties as a solution to building community.
You can't count parties as part of your work.
Right. Basically.
You can't include
exactly.
that in the work that you're doing.
Right.
It really can't, yeah.
I think games can be effective fun work, though, because it often forces people to play together that don't know each other and communicate on some level, and it's still fun, you know, but, and so you can get people to participate, but that's a little bit better than a party.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's important, like, if you're having something like this, like a community building thing, or there's a meeting or something, that there's also something fun, like, afterwards, where people, they've met each other, they talked, they sat down, they put everything out, and then afterwards they can have a little get-together or something fun. Because then people are more inclined to go because they know that it's not going to be just a lecture or something like that. There's going to be time for just socializing afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think something wrapped into one is good. Like you said, like games or community building games that are still fun, but at the same time, they're not alienating people.
Mm-hmm.
So wrapping that into a meeting also mm-hmm. helps.
Okay, so the next piece here is about how to help get people actually involved. And Mel's cornbread story. So Mel says, here's how you organize people. You say, hey, we're having a meeting about, you know, the, we'll just go with InfoShop. We're having a meeting about, like, kind of trying to, like, rejuvenate the InfoShop and do some outreach and stuff. Would you be willing to, like, make cornbread for the meeting? So this person, and you ask the cornbread, you ask for someone who, like, maybe came to the InfoShop once, right? And then someone who's more involved, you're like, would you be willing to facilitate the meeting, right? So you get people to have roles, right? Now, this involves somebody appointing themselves or some group of people appointing themselves to actually invite folks to do that. But the person who, like, is totally intimidated by the whole scene and is asked to make cornbread is like, first of all, they're going to be there with the cornbread. And second, they're going to feel like they contributed something. So there's this cool psychologist who I kind of like named Ernest Becker. And he talks about like the basis of self-esteem is actually making meaningful contributions to your community. So if you create opportunities for people to make meaningful contributions, even if they're seems to you like a very small thing, but someone who like has refused to speak at the teach-in 10 times might be willing to, well, actually that's someone who's already more involved. This would be like the could you make food for the meeting? Something that you'd ask a pretty new person to do. But it's gonna make them feel like, oh, they made the contribution, and they're gonna be proud that they provided the cornbread to the meeting. And then that person, the next time you ask them to do something that's a little bit more advanced. Well, do you remember how we talked about taking the notes and needing to make sure everybody, you know, we have this list of people who didn't make it to the meeting and they need the notes. Would you be willing to, like, call them up and tell them what happened at the meeting? you know, like something that's like you're confident the person's going to feel like they can do it and empowered, and that draws them further and further in. And this is something, this kind of thing, we really don't do in this community, and I think we might want to talk about the issues with that. I think people think that it's hierarchical to do that. And yet, the feedback that I've been getting from folks is that they feel like they're completely intimidated by meetings that they go to, and that they have no, they don't understand the issues, and they want to be involved, but they just don't have any way that they can get involved and contribute. So then the issue is like, is it more respectful and empowering to treat people like you already know and you'll give yourself a job when you're ready? Or is it more empowering and respectful to create an opportunity for them to move in to where they want to go, which is why they came to the meeting in the first place? They want to get involved, right? What's really the empowering thing? And are our concerns about non-hierarchy maybe getting in the way of actually being empowering? So I think that is a big issue in this community. And, you know, such that I was paralyzed from really doing this kind of practice for, like, the whole time that I lived here. That I was going to get called hierarchical for doing it. And yet, you know, it could really facilitate people getting much more involved and, you know, helping to lay out, like, a path. So what goes along with that kind of idea of creating opportunities for people to do things is that you can actually design projects in such a way as to maximize opportunities for people to, like, well, how can we break down this job so that there are pieces of it that are pretty discrete that we could get people involved with who maybe don't have experience with this thing before or who haven't done this kind of work before. How could we kind of break it down and then like maximize, like, oh, we've taken a job that Karen and I were gonna sit down and do tonight and we've now broken it up into 8 parts and we're only gonna do this one piece and we're gonna get seven other people to take like a little piece. They're then going to feel involved. They're going to feel like they made a contribution. They're going to learn skills along the way. So again, it's this like human development, maximizing opportunities for human development. But that doesn't just maximize the skills. It also maximizes people's relationship to the thing. And then they feel like important. And then they see their work. It's like out there, part of this thing that's going on. So a lot of times what we might call like dirty work or tedious work, we could maybe rethink that as an opportunity to get another person involved. And you do that by personal contact. You pick up the phone and say, hey, I seem to remember that you're interested in this thing or you came to this, that. Would you be able to, we need to like make some phone calls about it or we need to make a flyer. Did I remember that you like to do things on you? So you're constantly like thinking like what are people's skills and interests? And like how could you like draw them into doing something that they become, and also people's comfort, like who, you know, seems, you know, comfortable. Like there are certain people who've come to our teach-ins who like will stand up and ask like a very complicated question. Well, maybe we should invite them to speak next time and help them through the process of doing that.
I think that kind of points out a really big difference. I think, well, okay, and first off, I have to preface everything I say, because I'm from Denver. So everything I'm talking about is coming from the Denver community, not here. But is at meetings, tasks are usually, we ask, who wants to take notes? Or who wants to make a flyer? We don't, like, ask someone, do you want to make the flyer? You know what I'm saying? And which I think is kind of coming off of this idea of, like, of an anarchist principle of voluntary association, everyone wanting to do things because they want to do them. But, I think it's much more empowering when you actually ask someone if they would be willing to do a task, but it's something we never do, I think.
Well, again, it's also like, I mean, in a lot of groups I work with, when we have a list of tasks, it's totally voluntary association within the group. But this is an issue of, like, this is a little bit kind of a different concept of, like, well, how do you get people to want to be in the group?
Yeah.
And like breaking up the tasks are ways to get people into your group. And then once they're in, then maybe they're gonna feel empowered to to volunteer for something, right? But what happens when people are new to this scene, to a, either to a community or new to the issue, is they don't feel empowered to say, I'll do it, because they're like, what if I mess it up? Then everyone's going to be mad at me, or I don't know how to do that, or I don't even know what you're talking about, right? And they don't say those things, right? So you don't know. So the issue is like with newer people, like kind of like trying to like create opportunities. And but also with people like that are supporters of your community, but who never are going to come to a meeting and get a task. But you know, like, oh, well, so-and-so's mom seems really interested in this stuff. Do we have any mom jobs? Oh, my God. Well, we need a letter written to the newspaper about the police brutality that just happened. You know, like, thinking about how to involve those folks who aren't in the central group. Like, how to make them feel involved. How to make them feel that they're really part of it. You know, and even if you know they won't come to a meeting. So, like, I'm always thinking about, like, you know, how I can get my mom doing something, right?
I think it goes beyond even newcomers too. I think it also applies to people that are consistently marginalized by like the society at large. Like I've talked to a lot of women that are frustrated that there isn't more, you know, like literature, like pieces written by women about it, like within the anarchist scene or whatever. And a lot of it comes back to the fact that like white men have been encouraged to speak up and women haven't been. And I think that's maybe another thing, is if you just leave it for the people that are like apt to speak their mind, it'll just be those people that have always been empowered to do so. Mm-hmm. So I think that's
which
isn't
as non-powerful as it may appear.
Right, exactly. Right. That's something that's always frustrated me about the anarchist communities. Yeah. It's always under this veil of like, mm-hmm. we don't want to put mm-hmm. forth a structure, we don't want to force anyone into it. But by having this sort of informal structure, mm-hmm. it brings out these hierarchies that we've just been brought up with and we perpetuate
and
them.
It's more dysfunctional because we're not getting it or facing it. And,
yeah.
And I think the same is true with what you're saying about just having voluntary tasks and people taking them, because you know, if you're not careful about the same people always doing stuff, that's another way that you perpetuate it.
Right. I mean, I've been in so many meetings where it's like, there are some people at the meeting that don't speak up much. And so we're like, okay, who's going to do the press release? And no one speaks up. So then one of the like most experienced people in the room is like, fine, I'll do it. And like more of a process about that, like, well, I would be willing to like help someone do it. You know, is there anyone who'd be interested in learning how to do a press release? Then you might get a volunteer, right? Or also that just what I noticed works also is like sometimes you're like, well, I'll be responsible for finding someone to do it. Then I go outside the meeting and make some calls to some people who I know are interested and be like, hey, we need to do a press release. Would you be willing to do that? I'll work on it with you. So then you're not necessarily pressuring the people who are in the room to take it up, but you're kind of like trying to like not just have the same old people doing it every time. So there were a couple hands, I think. Yeah. Okay. But I used the word dirty work, and this is a really obvious point, but again, I just want to mention it. I think a lot of people already know this, but at the same time as we're wanting to like share the tedious work because that creates opportunities, it's also important for people who are perceived as like whatever, like more experienced folks in the group to make it really clear that you also are perfectly happy doing things like taking out the trash and handing out leaflets and stuff. And I think like probably most anarchists do a pretty good job of like having everybody share in the dirtiest work most of the time, you know, like clearly doing that, but obviously like at the same time as you're wanting to like use those things to create opportunities, you're also wanting to like show that you're not like too good to do that stuff. So it's, I think that's pretty obvious. On this, I think now it's jumping around a little bit, but on this business of like how, I'm going to sort of stick with this theme of like how to like share out the tasks more and how to make that happen in a non-hierarchical way, or less not offensively hierarchical way, is the whole buddies idea. That like people who are experienced and who have done whatever the task is a few times already should never do it alone again. So be like, yeah, I'm gonna go, I'm gonna make the flyer. Like, I guess like I'm the bottom liner on the flyer. Like, who wants to like sit and go through it with me and make sure we don't make mistakes and stuff? To kind of like acquire a buddy who is as inexperienced as possible, unless it's a really high level task. But generally, like, you acquire a buddy, and the experienced people should always try to take a buddy with them to do the thing. And if that's like